Financial Katrina by Professor David Harvey. City University of New York, October 29th, 2008. For more, see www.davidharvey.org.
In introducing this, I can't refrain from, since I always do this, I have to get it out of my system, quoting from Karl Marx. Volume 1 of Capital, where he says this: "The bourgeois," read Wall Street, "drunk with prosperity and arrogantly certain of himself, has just declared that money is a purely imaginary creation. Commodities alone are money," he said. But now the opposite cry resounds over the markets of the world. Only money is a commodity. As the heart pants after fresh water, so pants his soul after money, the only wealth. In a crisis, the antithesis between commodities and their value form, money, is raised to the level of an absolute contradiction. It's a pretty good description of where we've been over the last couple of years. My take on neoliberalism is very much shaped by my interpretation of what happened here in New York City during the fiscal crisis of 1975. That fiscal crisis of this city was part of a general crisis in municipal finance right across America, but it was deeper here for some very particular reasons. That crisis of municipal finance followed on after the crisis of 1973, which was a crisis that started in property markets, which spread over to financial institutions. And during that financial crisis of 1975 in this city, a number of things happened. In effect, the investment bankers created a financial coup against the elected government of New York City and essentially took over all of its financial functions and mandated its policies. And out of that, there came two basic principles as to how I think of the practice of neoliberalism as opposed to the ideological mask. And the two basic principles which came out of this crisis were this. The first was that we should protect financial institutions at all costs, and that in the event of a conflict between the well-being of financial institutions and the well-being of a people, you chose the well-being of financial institutions. Now, this was not exactly a new principle, because as Leo points out, that has been around for some considerable time, the protection of the financial institutions, but it became very explicit in 1975. The second principle that came out was that that the role of government was not to go away, but to change its mission. Its mission was no longer a mission to look after the well-being of a population. Its mission was to create a good business climate, and therefore to encourage investment at all costs. And the theory behind that was, of course, that if you get investment in, then eventually, you know, a rising tide will raise all boats, or something will trickle down from the ceiling, or something of that sort. But that these two principles then were, for me, what guided neoliberal politics from 1975 onwards. They became central to the way in which the International Monetary Fund approached countries like Mexico in 1982. Basically bailing out Mexico in order that Mexico could pay back the investment bankers of New York, and then disciplining Mexico to the idea of a good business climate over time. So this became a central way in which neoliberalism operated. But behind that, there was also this problem of why was it that the government was no longer supposed to be concerned with people? And that's where the neoliberal mask came in. Well, it all has to be left to the market. It all has to be about personal responsibility and individuality, and you can't expect the nanny state to take care of you and all that kind of thing. So the ideological mask was one thing, and the actual practice I've talked about was another. Now, I've been asked several times over the past few weeks, do I think this crisis is the end of neoliberalism? My answer is no, because they're doing exactly the same damn thing again, except that this time it is, in a sense, a financial coup against the whole of the people of the United States. And I suggest that we start to think about it in those terms. I mean, this incredible moment when actually all government disappeared apart from Bernanke and Paulson. They were actually dictating policy. And actually government Sachs was right in the middle of it. And while I agree with Doug that the concentration of centralization of more power on Wall Street is maybe not such a bad thing in some ways, I want you to also to look at it as yet another stage of the way in which class power is being concentrated, incredibly so, in fewer and fewer institutions, and that class power is being used in a very specific way, and it's being used to, if you like, rob the government of assets, and via that, to rob the people of the United States of their assets. And I want to look at this also very concretely by looking a little bit at what happens on the ground, and this is one of these rare occasions when I'm actually going to use something that assists me. This is the pattern of foreclosures in Cleveland. Every dot is a foreclosure. Every dot is a particular personal history and tragedy. Look at the way in which this relates to the subprime lending, and look then at the distribution of the African-American population, and you see straight away why I call one big element of what's happened recently a financial Katrina. And actually, you will find similar maps in Baltimore, Detroit, Pittsburgh, every city in the United States. So I therefore want to stop talking about a subprime crisis. I want to talk about an urban crisis, a crisis of urban populations, and particularly a crisis of vulnerable populations. Now, if you're in California and Florida, in Arizona, you will find a rather different pattern to this. It's more on the periphery, where speculative development housing ran into the problem of where was it going to find a market. And so the subprime stuff occurs in a different area. But let's just think more clearly about this particular map and what it means in terms of the dynamics of urban change and the dynamics of what is happening to people in these urban settings. Now, at the same time as this is going on, what we find is also that municipal governments are again getting to the brink where they cannot provide the services that they once provided. They're having to cut back for two reasons. First, their main source of income is the property tax, and that is declining. Secondly, they're being shut out of the credit markets for all the reasons that we've been hearing. And they cannot borrow at any kind of reasonable level. It's very difficult for them to cover any expenditures right now. So at the same time as this crisis is unfolding in neighborhoods and various areas of urban areas, what we're finding is the inability of municipal government to really respond in any kind of creative and constructive way, because they're having less and less in the way of assets to be able to do something about it. Now, this then raises, I think, another interesting question. When you look back historically, you find that there have been many financial crises over the last 25, 30 years. And if you care to look, you have something systemic going on, which is many of them are actually triggered by a collapse in the property market. The Swedish banking system essentially went belly up in 1992 because of excessive involvement in speculation in property. In the earlier years, we had our own savings and loan crisis, remember? It was a huge one, cost about $200 billion to get out of that one. The crisis that unfolded in Southeast Asia began in Thailand, and again, the property market was heavily involved. The end of the Japanese boom at the end of the 1980s had a lot to do with excessive engagement in land and property markets, as well as excessive engagement on the stock exchange. And the biggest of all, I've already mentioned, in 1973, there was a huge property market crash which occurred before the oil price hike in the fall. occurred about 6 months before, and it was a very serious one, and it brought down many financial institutions. And if you want to look at what happened to some of the shares on the London Stock Exchange, and you look at the value of real estate investment trust shares, there you see the graph of what happened. But the top graph here is most interesting. It's the run-up of mortgage acquisitions beginning in the late 1960s. So there's a very interesting question we have to ask about these dynamics, which is why is it that throughout this period, there's been this strong association between, if you like, the expansion of the mortgage debt and the expansion of property markets and all the rest of it. And actually, there are signs of this sort of thing, which again, go back. I mean, one of the first places I looked at this was in Second Empire Paris, where there was a property boom from 1853 to 1868. And then in 1868, there was a huge, humongous crash of the financial institutions. So there's been a long, long history of this within capitalism, and we're rerunning this history, except that we're rerunning it at a different scale, and I want to get back to that in just 1 minute. The big question then is, why this relationship? And part of the answer here is that throughout the history of capitalism, there has always been what I call a capital surplus disposal problem. Capitalism is always about producing a surplus in the form of a profit, which means there's more of something at the end of the day than there is at the beginning of the day. Part of that more gets put into making more the next day. So in fact, what you have is a perpetual process of compound growth rate. And in fact, if you look at the history of capitalism, you see that throughout the history of capitalism, we're looking at a 3% growth rate when capitalism is healthy. And when you have a sort of mad cow disease economy like we have right now, you're looking at a zero rate, and so there have been periods when it's zero. But a healthy capitalist economy is going at that kind of clip, which means you've always got to find some place to put your 3%. Where's the 3% growth going to be? And there are various ways which you can do it. One is you expand geographically. In the 19th century, you went to the United States or you went to Argentina. More recently, people have been sending their surplus capital to China and getting their 3% or 10% out of China. So the 3% growth rate has to be absorbed somehow. And the result of this is that there are various historical periods where there is what we call an excess of liquidity, a tremendous amount of money floating around and nobody knows exactly what to do with it. And actually, if you look back at this period when I noticed this rise of the mortgage rates in the late 1960s, when you go back and you read the financial press, everybody's talking about an excess of liquidity. There's too much money and nobody knows what to do with it. Where should we put it? Well, let's put it into property, because the interesting thing about property is, particularly when you're building it and financing and all the rest of it, you don't realize you've overproduced for a number of years. You know, it takes a long time to come online, so you can absorb the surplus liquidity for a number of years before eventually you get some sort of crash of some sort. Now, it's interesting, if you go back just 4 or 5 years ago, it sounds astonishing right now, which is why I read you the quote from Karl Marx. 5 or 6 years ago, the head of the IMF was saying the world is awash with surplus liquidity. We don't know what to do with it. And what the evidence is now showing is that the political pressure was put on to try to push this liquidity into new areas, particularly with this mortgage finance stuff. And there was political pressure put on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to start to actually really push this stuff and get into the subprime business. There was political and economic pressure put on all of these other mortgage finance companies to find a place to put it. And so increasingly, as you see, they start to put it into the subprime world because there was a place where you could start to get some sort of quick profits. But as Leo mentioned, this idea had been there from the Community Reinvestment Act of late 1970s, and there had been sort of minor pushes in this direction. And in fact, subprime mortgages had worked for certain segments of working population and worked quite well, until this excessive push, which just came from the fact that there's surplus liquidity around. And this surplus liquidity seems to me to be really the heart of what the problem is. Now, Part of this, of course, throughout this whole history of this association between property markets and financial institutions, each time this thing has picked up, it's required financial innovation to be able to do it. This was true in 1853 in Paris. It's true in 1945. A lot of the surplus liquidity that was available in productive capacity after 1945 was absorbed through suburbanization, the suburbanization of the United States. But that suburbanization required new configurations of finance, new kind of state policies, particularly the GI Bill of Rights, the tax incentives to, you know, the tax breaks on mortgages and all those kinds of things, and deals with the whole kind of structure of mortgage finance was revised to facilitate suburbanization. And of course, that process came to an end at the end of the sort of 1960s, 1970s. And so you then start to find a different kind of a dynamic setting in. So financial innovation becomes crucial. And one of the big financial innovations that was necessary this time around was this urbanization process, which was going to absorb the surplus, had to go global. So it went to China, it went to India. The interesting thing to me is almost any city you go to around has a massive kind of building projects on. And of course, we've had more major building projects in New York City over the last few years than we've had for many, many a year. So that actually there had to be a reform of the financial kind of structure, a real push, and it became global, but it also involved this securitization process. So you start to find mortgages suddenly become securitized, that is bundled up in certain ways, and then they get into these peculiar institutions, and these peculiar institutions started to vent other institutions, and so you do indeed get innovation upon innovation in the financial sector, which in the end nobody really understands. I mean, I still find it very, you know, you go and read books and it turns out a lot of people inside of it don't really understand what it's about and don't really know how it's really working. So the financial system is innovating partly to accommodate these sorts of configurations. So the financial system then starts to come up with derivatives. Now, the derivatives market is an astonishing affair. It's about betting on the value of an underlying asset, but the underlying assets are very peculiar. For instance, the derivatives market on weather futures is worth $4 billion. $4 billion are circulating on weather futures. And of course, we created other fictitious markets like pollution rights, so that you can buy and sell rights to pollute. That's a huge market, by the way, and the derivatives in that are huge. And actually, I was terrified just a few years ago when I read that something like $286 trillion are circulating in the derivatives market. And actually, that at that time, fitted with the fact that the global economy at that time was worth $40 trillion. And you kind of go, well, what's going on here? Well, of course, it's a lot of churning, and only 10% of that is actually kind of likely to be called upon at any point of time. So, yeah, but even so, you say, well, that's $28 trillion out of $40 trillion. You know, what's going on here? Well, the last data I saw for September 2008 was that $600 trillion are circulating in this market. Now, we like to think that there's a big crash going on in Wall Street, but in fact, what you find is that some of the hedge fund people are pulling out major. Some of the hedge funds are going bust. But last year, I'd remind you that actually four hedge fund managers drew down personally over $3 billion each out of those markets. The leading one, whose name is John Paulson, and I still don't believe he's no relative of Hank, but pulled down $3.7 billion in 1 year. And I wanted to suggest to you that actually, when you look at this, you say to yourself, what does that all represent and where's that all coming from? What we've seen in the African-American population is the biggest asset loss in its history, a huge loss of asset values. That's what the Cleveland map shows. And I'd like to suggest that that loss is actually a set of values that somehow or other get percolating up to the top and which are being absorbed by that upper class at the top. In other words, we've got to think of that connection between that map of Wall Street that map of Cleveland and what's going on Wall Street. And we have to be prepared to call this a class phenomena. It is robbery of one segment of the population to the benefit of another segment of the population. And at the same time, the robbers have a gun to our head in the sense that they're saying, well, look what happened when you made Lehman go bankrupt. Well, you know, all the credit froze, everything froze, you know, and then we can come in, just a few bunch of us, and we can draw up that astonishing document that basically said, give us $700 billion. Otherwise, we'll shoot you. And then they let Lehman go, and then, well, they let Lehman go already, and they said basically, this is the only way we can stabilize it. And in a sense, it's blackmail. It's an incredible blackmail. Then they, of course, have now taken equity stakes in banks. And you kind of say, equity stakes, well, that means to me they're nationalizing the banks. Why can't we say it's nationalization? Let's call it nationalization, and then let's do some of the things that people here are calling for, which is to say, well, if we are nationalizing the banks, then we should really take them over so that the banks actually start to behave in ways which are beneficial to people. That is, we have to think about how to organize the banking system so that it can go into a place like Cleveland and it can stabilize the situation, it can rebuild neighborhoods, and it can rebuild lives. How are you going to do that? Well, those five banks that are left on Wall Street ain't going to do it on their own. We already know that they're not going to use the money they've got in any way to actually lend to anybody. They're just going to use it to take over other institutions, as Doug pointed out. So what do we do? I think at this point, we either invent a new bank, and I'm on record as saying we should create a national reconstruction bank, and we should put $500 billion of that $700 billion into that bank and then give it as its mission to go into places like Cleveland, work with the municipal government to try to reconstruct neighborhoods. And while you're at it, maybe you should be thinking about completely reconfiguring the U.S. urban system around the idea that it should be energy efficient, that it should be consolidated around the possibility of real jobs and employment and all the rest of it. In other words, we should have a national reconstruction program, which would be dramatic that way. And maybe what we should do is take over one of the banks, let's say Citibank, and say, okay, we're going to take you over 100%, and this is what you're going to have to do. Okay, let the others compete with them if they can. Do something of that kind. In other words, we've got to do something of this kind, because unless we're going to do this, we're just going to simply get out of this mess and be in it again. But we're going to be in it again for a very, very simple reason. And the simple reason is this. That I've mentioned the 3% compound rate of growth. Well, in 1850, the total global economy in terms of, you know, goods and services in the market was something like $135 billion, which is a constant value. In 1950, it was $4 trillion. In 2000, it's $40 trillion. It's now around $46, $48 trillion. Imagine 3% compound rate of growth on that. Or another way of imagining it would be this, that a 3% compound rate of growth on activity, which was really confined to about 50 miles radius around Manchester and a few other hotspots, is one thing. A 3% compound rate of growth on everything that's going on in China and Japan and much of South and Southeast Asia, and what's going on in Europe and what's going on in North America and much of Latin America and the Gulf states. Just think about that and imagine what kind of world we're going to be living in 50 years' time at 3% compound rate of growth, because, you know, 3% on $40 trillion means in 15 years you're going to have $80 trillion, and then 15 years after that you're going to have $160 trillion. You're going to double economic activity every 15 years. That you cannot possibly do. And the result of that is you're going to get these fictitious bubbles where assets are going to be pushed up very hard and they're going to crash again. In other words, the only way we can come out of this crisis is to go straight into the next one. And at that point, you say to yourself, well, actually, it's time we did what we really have to do, which is to grab hold of the surplus. And the people who make the surplus, i.e. workers, should control the surplus, and they should be able to dispose of it. They're the ones who should start to think about the reconstruction of an entirely different world. The folk on Wall Street are still making massive amounts of money, those that are on the left. Some of them have been weeded out. They're still making massive amounts of money. And there's a great line which Andrew Mellon once said. He said, in a crisis, assets return to their rightful owners, i.e. him. And what we're seeing right now is assets not being consolidated in such a way that they can be used for the benefit of everybody, but assets being reconstituted and reconstructed around a particular class configuration. And what we are seeing right now is the consolidation and real consolidation and centralization of massive class power. And the only way to fight that is through massive class struggle back. Now, the question has arisen, what do we do immediately? I don't want to take to the streets until November the 5th. And I hope to hell on November the 5th we have a reasonable result. I'm not clear on that. But on November the 5th, I think we should take to the streets, because that is when the pressure is going to have to be on. And I think Hector's dead right that that's what we have to do. And this is a moment when it seems to me the left has to get its act together around both the interpretation but also the understanding of the dynamics of this and where it is likely to lead. We cannot let it escape. This is a very crucial moment. The mask is off. The reality is there staring us straight in the face, and we have then to confront that politically and economically as quickly as we can. Thanks very much.